Welcome to podcast number 63 of My Favorite Detective Stories. Today's date is August 13th, 2019, and I'm your host, John A. Hoda. Our guest this week is Bruce Maitland. Bruce's interest in missing persons began terribly and abruptly on March 19th, 2004. His 17-year-old daughter, Brianna Maitland, went missing. Life changed from that point on into a living hell that no parent should ever go through. In the years since, the endless searching and sleepless nights, not knowing where or what happened to her, has taken its toll and continues to this day. In the last few years, an idea was brought to Bruce by his friend and private investigator, Greg Overacre, who donated much time and energy to assisting Brianna to start the Private Investigations for the Missing Foundation. It is an unfortunate reality that police have limited resources and time, and private investigators can sometimes get answers from people unwilling to speak to the police. It is also an unfortunate reality that the costs of private investigators are beyond the ability of most people to afford. Bruce started this foundation, Private Investigators for the Missing, to help solve this problem for missing persons and their loved ones. He does this to honor his daughter, Brianna. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, John.
Well, I got to ask all my guests, how's the weather down there in southeastern Pennsylvania today?
It's warm today. Scattered thunderstorms.
Well, it is August, and we're having the same weather here in southwestern Connecticut, although it's been a gorgeous couple weeks lately. Long daylight, of course, low humidity. I don't mind standing on somebody's doorstep after, 6 o'clock at night, and people aren't so anxious to slam the door in my face when, the screen doors are open. So it's it is these days that as an investigator that you like, because it's those days in December when it's dark at 4:30 and you step into a slush puddle that you realize that you're really working for your money. So anyway, we got acquainted I guess it's been over a month now. As we record this, today is August the 2nd, 2019. And we met in New Orleans at the CrimeCon conference. And what I understood it to be was a gathering of persons that are interested in true crime and the true crime genre, both in what is on regular TV, cable TV, podcasts, books, anything to do in the area of true crime. And as I was walking around the conference area, I came across your table and we started talking. And I said, for a very unique reason, I felt that you should be on the podcast, and you were so gracious to say that you would come on. So I really appreciate that. So first, tell me why you were at CrimeCon, and then we'll start getting into the bigger story.
Well, I started a nonprofit, Private Investigations for the Missing. I decided to go to CrimeCon pretty much at the urging of a couple of guys on my board who were podcasters. And they just said, well, Bruce, this is a great way to highlight your organization and get it up in front of a lot of people that are interested in that sort of thing. And so I thought, why not? We'll give it a go.
So and more eyeballs, more listeners, really important for what you're trying to accomplish. And we'll talk more about the foundation later. And you can explain it more in detail towards the end. But I've got to ask you again, as many people have probably asked you in the past, just tell us how you started getting into this world of true crime.
Well, my daughter at 17 went missing in March of 2004. And that I've been on a kind of a constant search ever since to find her or find answers, find the people responsible. And she was, she left work at a kind of a bed and breakfast that she was working at. And she left sometime after 11 o'clock on a Friday night when they were done for the night. And her car was found about a mile away from this place, and it was bashed into the side of a abandoned building. And no one has ever seen her or anything since.
Wow. And that's the basics of the story. Now, your daughter's name, full name, so that my listeners will know who to keep a thought for.
Brianna Alexandra Maitland.
Okay. And how old was she at the time of this event?
17.
So going on 15 years now, she'd be 32 or ish. So,
yes.
All right. So, and this happened in what locale, for lack of a better word?
Well, this happened in the town of Montgomery up in northern Vermont near the Canadian border. It's a real rural ski resort area. Jay Peak Ski Resort is there. It draws a lot of people in, you know, there's a lot of, small, quaint hotels, bed and breakfasts, that sort of thing in some of the small towns that surround the area.
So it has two components to it. The first is that it's a small rural area, but it has out-of-towners, and it has people coming in from maybe out of state and maybe even out of the country because of its location near Canada.
That's correct.
Yeah. So working at a bed and breakfast, finishing up the evening shift, her car is found. How many miles away from her workplace, did you say?
About a mile, a little more maybe, yeah.
And from what I recall you telling me before, there was something peculiar about the way the car was left at that scene?
Yeah, the car wasn't just off the side of the road or something. The car had been backed into this abandoned building and backed in with enough force that the back end of the car actually cleared the old stone foundation and bashed into the building a few inches, and that's kind of what stopped it. Looking at the pictures, you can almost see, I think it can be surmised that maybe it was hit hard enough that the back tires, lifted up enough so that it was stuck there.
Gotcha. Now, in more conversation about this, how was a vehicle first discovered?
A passerby discovered it and said that the headlights were still on. It was a four-door Oldsmobile. I think it was a Delta 88 or something, a big sedan, a car that her grandfather, when he passed away, just kind of came into the family, and it was just her first car to kind of run around, an old clunker. No keys were ever found. There was stuff scattered on the ground by the driver's side. And, later on, a second passerby came through, and it was actually it was an ex-boyfriend that they had broken up probably 6 months before that. He just happened to see her car and stopped, and he shut the car doors and shut the lights off and then went on home. And that was probably by 2-3 in the morning at that point.
Ex-boyfriend.
Yeah. And he got killed in a car crash about 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I won't say anything negative about him, but did he ever become a person of interest?
Oh, yes, he did early on. He was one of the first people that was looked at and kind of really gone through, and I came to the conclusion and the PIs that I have working for me and the state police all kind of came to the conclusion that he really wasn't involved other than he just happened to be there. And I know to a listener that doesn't know the area that well, that sounds kind of odd. We've had a lot of people, over the years say, oh, well, the ex-boyfriends, and it just wasn't the case in this instance. That little ski town, if you were if you happen to be anywhere on the western side of that town, there's a two-lane paved road there, and that's really the only way in. So anybody that's anywhere west of the town and going in, and he was actually, you know, he lived east of the town, so he had to go by there to get home.
So it made sense for him to be there. But also, you know, when you said that he shut the doors and turned the lights off, my thought was that maybe as a possible perpetrator, that he would not want to draw attention to the vehicle because maybe it was left in a hurry and he wanted to like button it up and close it up and so that it wouldn't be more noticeable. But at some point he came forward, or did he come forward?
Well, the interview, that was probably one of the first interviews done.
Okay.
Of the boyfriend. And, you know, they had a number of interviews with him, and they had some hard interviews with him. And the state police in particular had some hard interviews where, you know, he was crying in the interview room, they told me. And, they just felt after a number of interviews and different things that, he was not involved.
But unfortunately, by him doing what he did, his fingerprints and possibly his DNA was left at the scene of this vehicle. True.
It's possible. I don't know whether he was ever fingerprinted. The car was eventually taken down to the police in Pound Manor and gone through for fingerprints, DNA, that sort of thing. There's a lot of prints on the car. It's a car, you know, a lot of people have touched over the years, and none of those prints have ever made a match to anyone that could be called a person of interest, really, yet, and just haven't at all, most of them.
No, I didn't mean to go down that rabbit hole, but it just, you know, as an inquiring mind and, you know, thinking about, well, the ex-boyfriend, that those two things kind of like raised red flags in my mind. But it was later discovered by a state trooper, as I understand. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, the following morning, the state trooper came by, saw the car, I guess went out, threw some stuff that was on the ground back into the car, and then called for a tow truck, which it was a local garage, 3-4 miles away, that did some of the state police work. And they called the tow truck, and the tow truck had the car towed. And then the state trooper went home for the weekend and, you know, never filed a report or anything on it, just left the file in there until he came back to work, probably the following, following Monday or Tuesday night or something like that.
And when did you start to become concerned?
Well, she was living with a girlfriend at the time, and the girlfriend's father and his girlfriend. And so her girlfriend had gone away for the weekend also, and Brianna had left a note saying she would see her. And when the girlfriend came back, the note was there, and it was obvious Brianna had never came back to where she was, so... she called us and asked us if we knew where Brianna was, and and we didn't. And at that point, you start to become a little pretty concerned. But it was not unusual at the time. For sometimes Brianna had a number of different friends, and she would kind of crash around to different ones.
Okay, so some point, though, it became obvious that things were amiss. So what were your next steps?
Well, the next step immediately was to call around to Brianna's friends and see if they knew where she was. And nobody did. So we went down the next day and filed a missing persons report. And when we were in the police station, the officer that actually took the pictures of the car and filed the report was standing in the kind of in the rear area of the station there, where he could overhear the receptionist and us talking. And he called us back and he said, you know, is this your daughter's car? He had a picture of it. And then at that point, that was just kind of all hell broke loose, you know, because we knew at that point, you just kind of know something really bad has happened.
Yeah, her car. Yeah,
it's a whole nother stage from her in a car off somewhere to, you know, the car being bashed into a house and Brianna.
Right. So at that point, it got accelerated very quickly from being a missing persons report by you to something much more serious.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, but we felt so. Anyhow,
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Now, you thought so.
Yeah.
What was the police response at that time?
Well, the police response was, well, she probably just left with a bunch of friends and she'll be back in a few days. And so they really, although they did their dutifully as far as filing and taking the report, I felt there wasn't really much concern at that end. And it turned out later that they really didn't probably do much for, you know, a good another week.
So a week passed the day that you walked in, which was still several days from the time she left the restaurant, Bed and Breakfast.
I mean, it didn't pass for us. We immediately went out looking for her, my son and I, and, mm-hmm. you know, just went to anybody that had anything to do with it. Brianna, we started, you know, the logical places. We started where she worked and started talking to people. And then we started talking to friends. And then my wife at the time there, we made posters up and we started hanging posters around. So it just, for us, it started right at that moment.
Gotcha. Which, you know, sometimes families and loved ones will unfortunately abdicate their familial duties to law enforcement, thinking that they're the experts and will take a passive role at this point in time. But it's not only taking a passive role, it's also, and I understand this as well as you do, that they're dealing with something that is mind-numbing or horrific or something that is just incomprehensible. And at the same time, could they take action? And you did. You and your wife at the time did take action and try to find out what was going on, try to keep your wits about you and try to do something. This is something that, I got thinking about with these types of cases, and that I think this is a perfect example for my listeners to understand that sometimes law enforcement has a policy of waiting 24 hours or waiting 48 hours or telling the person, the person that's making the report, that they're not going to take the report right away, that they're going to want to wait 24 or 48 hours. But here were legitimate extenuating circumstances that led you to believe that there was something amiss here and that this was not her going off with her friends for a couple more days.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the kind of things that I think, you know, in the future, families can say, well, I'm sorry that your policy says this, but here are the extenuating circumstances in this case that obviate or make your policy, this is an exception to your rule. So there is a time when a loved one or family can get in the grill of the cops and say, hey, look, these are A, B, and C. This is why I don't think this is just her going off to cavort with her friends for a couple days. First of all, it would have been during the week, and probably would she have been missing work and hours that she could be working, you know, because of this?
Yes, I mean, she was working two jobs at the time, and the plans were she was leaving work at 11:30, and then the next morning she was going to a town west, 15 miles west, to start work at a diner there. So, I mean, for her, it wasn't a night where she was going to be out running around anyhow.
Right.
She was going to go home, go to sleep, get up the next morning, and go to work somewhere else.
And you knew this at the time you reported it to the police.
Yes. And we went down to the other diner and, you know, oh, well, she just never showed up. Well, you know.
Yeah.
It just adds more fuel to the apprehension that, oh, my God, you know, this is just something awful going on here.
Yeah. So I didn't mean to beat these first 4 days to 2 weeks to death, but here you are going out and doing what you should do and what should have been done. That's my opinion by the local constabularies. However, they didn't, or they started to trail you and started to follow up with people that you were talking to. And What was their response to the fact that you had gone out and done some of this stuff on your own?
Well, we were kind of independent of each other, but they certainly got the impression pretty quick. Things kind of made the news, and we had a national search. Class Kids Search Center came up and did a search, and that, of course, made the news. And then by the time they kind of got in gear and actually started to do so many investigations, they were running into the fact that, you know, I had talked to this one and I had talked to that one. And, the lieutenant in charge of the investigation actually got angry because we were doing this. And it's, you know, you at that point, you don't care whether he gets angry. He's doing it. It's like, you're not doing your job. So we're trying the best we can.
Right.
To do what we're going to do at this end, and we're going to continue to do it. I mean, there's just no choices there. You just do what you need to do.
Oh, absolutely. And I understand that. Unless there was a real solid game plan from the jump, I mean, like right at that moment, from the minute that the cop connected your missing person report with the vehicle that he had towed 2 days, 3 days earlier, or more, then if there had been some kind of a game plan that you could feel secure in, and that they were going to go do things that made sense for the people with the power to do so, then you could still be involved, but you would have been rest assured that they were doing their job. They said they were going to wait a couple days for her to come back from whatever she was doing, in spite of the fact that her car was left at a near an abandoned house. Now, did I understand it right that it wasn't really visible from the road, or in the way it was set up?
No, the house is visible from the road. The house sets back a little bit from the road, but everything is visible from the road. Yes.
How far back from the road is it?
Oh, probably some 60 feet, 70 feet, maybe.
And in the reversing of the vehicle, was it reversed from the road onto a driveway, or did it go across the lawn, or how was it brought to, what was the direction from? I know I'm better at asking these questions, Bruce, than normal, but so from the roadway to the house, what path did it take?
Well, that's something that's always been kind of bizarre, and no one can really figure out the reason for that exactly. But the house had a driveway, which was essentially just a little gravel area adjacent to the road. It wasn't really a driveway. It's almost like a pull off, I guess would be the best way you'd describe it.
Okay.
And then there was the rest of the area was lawn. It was abandoned, so it was not mowed lawn or anything, but, right. But the car was driven actually past the house. And I'm just guessing here at this stage, but the car was probably driven 80, 90 feet past the house and then backed up into the house.
Okay. Across the lawn.
Across the lawn into the house. Yes.
Okay. So.
Which a lot of people have had different opinions on that. I mean, I have my own opinions possibly, you know, but.
Well, doors wide open and lights still on.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Gee, I'm going to go out with my friends for a couple days. And did the police know at the time that they met with you that passersby had seen the vehicle with its lights on, doors open?
No.
All right. So that's something new.
Because by that time, the doors have been shut, the lights have been, you know, killed.
Extinguished.
And yes. So.
All right. At what point in time did those people come forward and explain to the cops that they were one of the first people to go by and noticed it?
That actually took some time, that part of it.
Really?
I mean, that might have been, you know, a month in.
Wow. Okay. But another clue and another validation for you to have acted as quickly as you did.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the police set up there. I mean, it's a very rural area. The state police handle all matters relating to kind of criminal investigations in that state. You know, there's obviously county sheriffs and that sort of thing, but they kind of defer that all to the state police.
Okay.
So what you have is a small state police barracks 25 miles away from where the car was found, and a handful of people man it. And, you know, no, the very few people that are even in the patrol cars, you know, they don't know the area. They don't know anybody up there. You know, it's
stranger police.
They're starting from it's not like I'm just guessing, but I mean, in an urban environment where the local police maybe know, you know, who the bad actors are or who the, you know, they have a somewhat of a starting point.
Well, Bruce, I'd say that from my experience, the small town police, where there's an actual police department for a small town, and the cops grew up in that small town, went to the local high school, they know more people, even though they would have a better opportunity to have more of a connection with their community. However, it's still stranger policing, whether it's an urban environment, a small town environment. It's not community policing, and community policing is an oddity in today's world, still to this day. And unfortunately, and then also, but you're right about the state police. I mean, the state police from that barracks are assigned to that barracks. They could have lived somewhere else in the state during their life, or somewhere else, for all
they
that
did.
Matters.
Yeah.
And so for them, it's an 8-hour shift. They respond to calls, or in this case, they see a vehicle on the side of the road and they have it towed. So, I'm not going to go down that path any further, but it's certainly not knowing who the players are in that particular area, especially in a ski town where you have a lot of, like I said, out of towners, people up there just for the season, you know, seasonals. And then you might have people from out of state, out of the country. So, you know, it doesn't make for a real cozy relationship between the local constabularies and the people in their community. So you got started. The cops got a little upset with you because you had beat them to some of the witnesses. Kind of bring me along on the investigation and what's taken place. So just kind of walk me through. I hate to say it, but 15 years.
15 years. Yeah. Well, I mean, the first 2 years were pretty much hell. Bad relationships with the police, just kind of a nightmare with them. And then they transferred some of those people out, which, you know, I felt a couple of them were incompetent.
Okay.
And they brought in some more competent people, and they started to make some changes over the years in how they did procedures and different things, and which were all for the good.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was just, you know, I had a period there where the head of the state police and I met, and some of his top people, you know, they sit at my kitchen table and we had a meeting, and I just kind of let them have it all the way through. And when it was done, you know, they said, look, we're going to make these changes. We're going to make these changes, various different things of which were all well and good, but, you know, they did say, look, we're going to put two of our best people on this case, and this is going to be their case, and this is their priority case, and we're going to try this for a year and see if we can't really solve this. And they did that.
To their credit.
Yes, yeah. To their credit.
So initially, the street level troopers ho-hummed it and then soft-pedaled it. Those are not... those are legal terms.
So,
you know,
okay.
ho-hum and soft pedal. You had a supervisor that was angry with you for you doing their job, and but you were doing their job. And then after a few years, there was a change in leadership, which is good. Management and leadership recognized that they had a problem.
Yes.
Maybe their problem was as much to do with public relations as it had to do with an unsolved missing person that had some very serious implications to it. So, and that's maybe why it was also a public relations situation as well. So
most definitely it was a public relations, you know, for them, it was a public relations nightmare.
Yeah.
Because the news was on them. It's a small town. Not that much happens up there. you know, it was constantly, you know, I was, you know, doing news interviews, and the news would do their own stories, and it was a big deal in that part of the area.
And Vermont too. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, the Bed-Stuy section of Brooklyn, New York. We're talking about a small country state where there's probably more cows than people. But, you know, the point is that it was still it was big news for a small town in a relatively small state. And it was giving the Vermont Yes. State Police a black eye. So they then did the best they could at the time that they got into the fray. So,
yes. And then over the years, one of the things they said, well, the person that's, you know, one, they picked one of the people of the two people that they had picked out to do an investigation as a priority for this is going to be their job for a year. One of them went on to become the head of the state police. And he is now up there. And the other one became the chief of their criminal investigation. But even though he moved on, he was still my go-to guy, and he was still in charge of the investigation. And they did a number of things over the years. I mean, and they had a number of different people come and tell them stories, and they would follow up on those stories. And I had a PI come in, the first one, Greg Overacker, came in. He did some work. We would turn over that information to them. And so they worked it for quite a number of years until it got really cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the PIs that I have, Greg and Lou Barry, came on the scene and they started working it in their ways and just, you know, were able to gather additional information. People don't want to talk to the police, but they'll tell a PI something. And it just and that's in to summarize 15 years in a couple of minutes. That's where we are today.
Okay, I bet there were some false flags. There were some false highs, but then a lot of low lows.
Yeah,
and also with you had a or they or there had to be a winnowing of the leads that came in, separating the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. And then there was the nut cases and the nut jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And some people that had a plausible story, but when you scratched into it, you realized that they were just looking for attention. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so many times that scenario played out over and over again. Somebody would say, well, this and such person told me that they know what happened to Brianna. And, you know, and that takes on various forms. But then, when anybody talks to that person, they're like, well, I don't know nothing. I don't know anything about it. We talked about it, but I don't really personally know anything, you know, and it just so often that happens.
Very deflating.
Mm-hmm.
Now I understand. And then also over the years, there's been advances in DNA and crime scene investigation, but the crime scene was not treated like a crime scene for how many weeks?
Oh, probably, at least a couple of weeks,
right,
before they really did. I think they probably went out initially, did some looking around the site, brought some dogs out, I think, at one point, did a little of that with the dogs.
And then the vehicle
anything
itself
that would have made it a crime scene. Anything that they could have been found in a crime scene by that point, there just was nothing there to find.
Mm-hmm. And then the vehicle itself too was they released it back to you. They
called us and said, you know, we're done with the car, you know, make arrangements to come get it.
Mm.
So we got the car and that was one of the huge mistakes they told us years later that they just, you know, and that's one thing they've changed too. As long as they have an open case with the car, that car will never leave the impoundment yard. It's never done until the case is closed.
Mm.
And it's too bad because now with modern DNA, there might have been a lot there in that car.
Sure.
It is no longer accessible.
Okay. So, you know, I've used this phrase before with other circumstances, both in my professional life and my personal life. And it's lighting a candle instead of cursing the darkness. It's easy for us to curse this or curse that, and our bad luck and our bad timing or that situation or the way that person talked to you or whatever. But there's another thing you can do, and that's light a candle. And instead of cursing the darkness, you lit a candle. You realize that although your situation has come into a place of stasis.
Stasis.
But for other people, you could do something for them. And by doing that, it's honoring Brianna. And that is the foundation for, and then you want to tell me the rest of the story about your foundation.
Yeah. I mean, my investigator, Greg Overacker, actually probably came up with the idea during some conversations we had, that, you know, we're both realizing it's staring us in the face, I'm just a middle-class guy. I'm a farmer. I sell some parts, that sort of thing. There's no way I can afford investigators' rates to be able to do the kind of work that I would like to have them done. Mm-hmm. And so we just recognized the need for it. And I mean, it took me probably almost 2 years from the time we talked about it. I knew it was a good idea to have this organization before I was ready for it. You know, I did my own fair share of cursing in the darkness, I guess, you know.
Yeah, you did.
I'm not ready. I wasn't ready to go into that room yet. And, and there's times when I'm not ready for it, different things. And so I kind of, you know, I move in and out. I was determined that once I realized that, there's just so many other people out there that are in the same situation that I am. And they need help. And they just, I learned through working with some good investigators, I learned the value of a good investigator. And there's definitely a place for an investigator in situations like this. And because of information, be able to keep going. And also, for me and probably any other parents or loved ones of missing people, when you have someone working on it, that's feeding you information from time to time or different things they find out, and it gives you, you're better equipped to go on and not fall into that dark hole.
Gotcha.
Because know something's happening I really have probably not done a good job of explaining it, but that's kind of the best I can do on that. You like to know something's being done, and you're working toward solving this, and solving it means.
So what I understand from what you explained to me when we were at CrimeCon is that the foundation was set up to act as a place where people could see the value of quality private investigations in missing person cases, and families or loved ones could come to the foundation and ask for financial assistance to afford the private investigator necessary to do the work, to follow up on leads or to create an investigative game plan to do what should be done in a missing persons case. Do I understand that right?
Well, it's not quite how I am putting this together. I mean, our goal was not to hand the families money.
Okay.
To be able to do this, our goal is to be able to gather a team nationwide of qualified investigators with the right mindset to be able to work on a missing person's case, and not just people that are after billable hours,
right?
It becomes sort of a part-time mission for them to be able to work this. And so I've had some investigators that, you know, weren't so good. So I don't want that scenario for a family. I want to be able to provide an investigator to that family that we know through screening processes to be able to know that investigator is going to do a good job as possibly can be done for that family. And so that's really kind of in a nutshell, that's a little closer, to kind of how you describe it. And it's something terribly simple to say in a couple sentences, but it gets infinitely more complicated as we kind of get up and rolling.
No. So I understand that you're trying to curate a national cadre of motivated, like-minded investigators that would employ best practice investigation techniques and into the missing person cases and apply it directly to those individuals' needs.
Yes.
Gotcha. No, that makes sense.
And we know that these guys need to be, I mean, I'm hoping to get some ex-police, not necessarily all ex-police, but I found there is value in that. There's a little bit of a police-to-police, police-to-ex-police rapport.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel that, and the other thing that I found out through, neither of my investigators that work for me were local to the area where Brianna went missing. So it infinitely ups the costs and the time and able to do some things. So we want to be able to find some people that have cases local to where they're at. You know, one it's going to be more efficient. And two is, you know, the more local person is, the more they're tied into the local culture and everything that's going on around there, that they could do a better job of it.
Gotcha. Much better understanding.
So right now we're in the fundraising process. We're also taking, if nothing else, contact information from people that are interested, and getting them on our contact list. But right now we need the money to get this thing up and going, because investigators, you know, they deserve to be paid for some work. There's no doubt about it. You know, they're earning their pay. And but we wanted to have a sort of a mission dynamics to it, that someone is willing to, maybe, you know, if they're around home messing with their computer, maybe they can do a little background, do some other different things, and try to, because they're going to be dealing with we hope we have unlimited resources, but that's going to be a little ways down the road, you know.
Sure. Yeah, I understand. So how can people get in touch with you, and but more importantly, how can people help fund the foundation? So just let's go through that a little bit, okay?
Well, if they just do a quick Google search, Private Investigations for the Missing is the name of the foundation. PrivateInvestigatorsForTheMissing.org is our website. And we have a button there that they can donate. I've got some volunteers now that are infinitely more associated with social media than I am.
Okay.
And, you know, they've got us up on Twitter and, oh my gosh, a couple different places that I don't know, because I'm just not that, you know, good with that stuff. But, the one thing we're now kind of looking at is, Amazon Smile. You see that pop up on your computer, you have the option to be able to have Amazon donate a portion of your purchase to a charity of your choice. So,
wow. And I think, I'll tell you a little tip right now. You get out there to, CrimeCon 2020 next year, and you have a little, 3x5 card, you know, with some nice marketing copy on there. And you tell all those crime readers, all those crime thriller readers, you know, or all those true crime readers, that their purchase through Amazon could help fund your program. I think they would hold on to that information and they would do something about that, honestly.
I would hope so, because it would cost you nothing but your time to be able to help us out that way, you know, for people that just don't have the resources to make donations.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me, that there you have a ready-made audience of people that are already focused on true crime, would be sympathetic to your situation, would be because of your familial connection to Brianna, but also what you're trying to accomplish. And yes. I think at a conference like that, with that many people in attendance, that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing to have. Tell you what, you make those postcards up. And we'll talk about that afterwards.
Okay.
You send me a bunch, and I'll be more than happy to all the different private investigative association meetings that I go to, conferences I'll go to, I'll put them out on the table, and not all of them, you know, some, you know, 20 at a table, and that'll get out to the private investigation group. So,
that would be great.
And I'm not bashful either. I could get up in front of a group of people and say, hey, by the way, my friend Bruce has this Amazon Smile charity that is something that you can fund that is a win-win, you know, something,
absolutely,
something as you as investigators could be helping him with through Amazon. And when you buy your chainsaw or you buy your pet food or you buy your books or buy whatever, you know, you're doing that a service. Oh, I think that's a wonderful idea. So
me too. And it pops up when you get on Amazon, it'll pop up. There's a pop up there sort of, and you know, Amazon smile and be quick about it because it disappears pretty quick.
Yeah. No, I understand. And so will my listeners. All right, Bruce, it's been wonderful. But one other thing, you did mention social media. In this world now with such a connection to social media, much more than 15 years ago, the fact is that this is on social media. Your unsolved case of your daughter's missing disappearance is on social media. And that is that breathing any new life into the leads, or is that keeping the cops busy with any new stuff that might give you hope?
Well, sure. I mean, the Facebook page, there's two of them. One is one I run. It's the family page. And the other is run by a friend of Brianna's. And, you know, there's been people that have one of my PIs is an administrator on one of the Facebook pages. And a number of different leads have come in over those Facebook pages.
Okay. Can you give me their...
It's been very useful in that sense.
Can you give me their names or the ones that you want to talk about?
As far as the leads or what?
No,
or,
the Facebook pages. So that,
The one is just Brianna Maitland Missing.
Okay.
And the other is Brianna Maitland Family Page.
Now, Brianna with two N's?
Yeah.
All right. So Brianna Maitland, M-A-I-T-L-A-N-D.
And the crawl space, the two guys at Tim and Lance that run the crawl space series, I'll plug them a little bit too, because they are on my board and they've helped me out a lot. But they've done a number of different shows on Brianna's cases too. So if anyone's interested out there, they can get some of that. When they're not listening to your podcast, John, they can check that out.
Okay. And what's the name of that again?
It's called Crawl Space Podcasts.
Okay. And we can make a link to that in the show notes and on the bottom of what I send out on all of my media. So, Bruce, it's been hard for you, I understand, but I'm glad that you took the time to come on my podcast to let my listeners know about your situation and how missing person cases can be done better, and some of the things that are very forward thinking on your part. And I think that these are good lessons to be learned. And I think a lot can be, good things can be generated from this. I wish you the best. I hope that you'll have a final resolution to your situation, of course, so that, you're in a place where you'll finally know. But in the meantime, rather than cursing the darkness, more than a couple years, you did light a candle eventually, and it is giving you purpose. It is giving you hope, and it is making the tragedy have a purpose that might have a higher purpose. So,
okay. Well, thank you, John, for having me on.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's JohnHoda.com. Our guest next week is Jerry Williams. Jerry has always been a storyteller, and after serving 26 years as a special agent in the FBI, she has plenty of stories to tell. During most of her bureau career, she worked major economic fraud investigations and was amazed at the schemes con artists and corrupt corporate and public officials would devise to steal other people's money. Jerry is the producer and host of FBI Retired Case File Review, a true crime history podcast where she interviews retired FBI agents about their high-profile cases and careers. With nearly 200 episodes, the podcast has been downloaded more than 2.7 million times. Toward the end of her federal law enforcement career, Jerry was appointed as a spokesperson for the Philadelphia Division of the FBI, taking on the responsibility of educating and informing the media and public about the Bureau. She has written several books, including Pay to Play and Greedy Givers.
Also, in her nonfiction book, FBI Myths and Misconceptions, A Manual for Armchair Detectives, she discusses the top 20 cliches and misconceptions about the FBI in books, movies, and TV. This episode is brought to you by my own crime thriller with a mystery twist, Odessa on the Delaware. A Russian gang enforcer is on a murderous rampage to take over the entire Philadelphia mob scene. A homeless vet doesn't know that he has the proof or that he's next on the list. The stakes are high for this deadly cat and mouse game set on the bleak Philly waterfront of years gone by. FBI agent Marcia O'Shea, a gunslinger from the Miami cartel days, is back in her hometown, quietly finishing out her career, but now is drawn into this case with a secret pushing her doggedly to follow the clues, only to uncover a greater secret that may get her killed in the final showdown. You can buy Odessa from your favorite online retailer. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you've enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to johnhoda.com and click on the podcast page. There you will find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they're available for you free with your email subscription to the podcast as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes from my book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here is my ask. If you were informed, inspired, and entertained by the stories today, don't be bashful. Please take a moment to share this podcast with your friends, then leave a review on your favorite podcatcher. If you like to leave a comment, you can do so on the website at www.johnhoda.com. That's johnhoda.com. Thank you so much, and have a great day.